Welcome to Challenging Climate, a podcast where we discuss the science, technology, and politics of climate change. I'm Pete Irvin, a climate scientist.
And I'm Jesse Reynolds, an environmental policy expert. Each episode, we bring on a guest with a unique perspective and deep expertise on climate change and put challenging questions to them.
In this episode, we spoke with Professor John Moore about the ways in which the cryosphere, that is the frozen and icy parts of the Earth, are changing and what that means for us, and what we can do about it. And in particular, we talk about a rather radical idea to make relatively small, but pretty big engineering intervention to help block warm water from melting the great ice sheets. And while it sounds quite radical, it looks like there might be some potential. It was an interesting discussion.
John Moore, he's a professor primarily of glaciology and of climate science more generally at the University of Lapland, where he's spent the majority of his recent professional career. But he's also had one foot in China, where he led the China Geoengineering Research Program. We touch on that a little bit toward the end of the program. Most of the conversation is in the mechanics, if you will, of ice. What's going on as the planet has warmed, what we expect to go on as the planet continues to warm. And listening as a non-scientist, I find it fascinating how each component of this ice on the Earth, called the cryosphere, the ice on land, the ice on water, permafrost, etc., operates very differently from each other, and quite often not what one would expect. So I found John to be an excellent tutor, if you will, a teacher of ice and climate change in general, and his proposal for slowing the melting of terrestrial ice sheets is indeed fascinating.
Now, our episode with John Moore. Welcome to Challenging Climate.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, so we like to always open by asking our guests a little bit about their background. So how is it you've come to be working on marine glacier geoengineering and solar geoengineering? What was your path?
Well, I did my degree in geophysics and then worked a little bit in the oil industry, very much for the dark side. Didn't like that tremendously much. And then was lucky enough to get the opportunity to go to British Antarctic Survey as a glaciologist, of which I had no clue what that entailed, actually. But I guess in those days, it didn't really matter if you had a clue about the job that you were joining. You just, if they somehow liked you, then you went for it. So I had, all in all, 10 years working for British Antarctic Survey, got to know a reasonable amount about Antarctic glaciers. And in the second half of that period, as a novelty, British Antarctic Survey took part in ice core drilling in Greenland. And I was the main guy on that because I developed a technique for ice cores called dielectric profiling during my PhD. And the ice coring community quite liked that. So that kind of got us a ticket to Greenland. And of course, Greenland's rather similar to Antarctica in some ways and entirely different in other ways. So after that, I kind of liked the Arctic. I liked the idea of dealing with people, not just nature. So I got a job in the Arctic Center in Finland, where there's a big group of people that look at things like anthropology and indigenous and environmental law, as well as the nature, let's say. And from that point, I kind of got interested in climate, got an opportunity to go to China, and they were very interested in the sea level side of things. And it was just around the time that geoengineering came back a little bit into fashion. And I caught that sort of wave and decided, well, I wonder what that might do for sea level rise. We had a simple model where we could simply change the radiative forcing, such as you would plan to do with geoengineering, and see what happens to sea level as a result. So I was in a kind of a random way able to connect the ice with geoengineering.
So the cryosphere is the word that scientists use to refer to the ice on Earth. And it's, of course, being affected by climate change now and is expected to be affected by climate change in the future. And I think the widespread understanding is ice is melting sea levels rising, and that's bad. But of course, the actual mechanics of this are a bit more complicated than that and have some surprises. So let's work through a few of the main elements, if you will, of the cryosphere and talk a bit about how climate change is playing out and is expected to. So let's start with that ice that's on land, the ice sheets near the poles in Antarctica and Greenland. What's happening there? How does it happen?
Yes, you're absolutely right that our intuitive concept of how ice melts, such as an ice cube in a warm room, doesn't really capture the whole complexity of the situation on the ice sheets. Thing is that Antarctica is a lot colder than Greenland. So although the area near the coast melts every summer, and in fact, because Antarctica is so big, it's actually a bigger melting area than occurs each year in Greenland. But as a whole, it makes a tiny contribution to the ice that ends up in the ocean from Antarctica. Most of the ice that's lost from Antarctica is lost frozen by carving usually giant icebergs from the floating ice shelves. And then the ocean currents carry them north and they melt. Contrast that with Greenland, where you have between a third and a half of the ice is melted in situ, actually on the ice sheet, every summer. And that flows off in as liquid water, either on the surface or it makes its way through moulins, giant holes that penetrate to the bottom of the ice sheet and come out underneath the outlet glaciers. And the rest, the other half to two-thirds, is effectively lost dynamically by this carving of icebergs process.
So with anthropogenic climate change, with what we are doing to the environment, which of those two sources of terrestrial ice sheets is expected to contribute more to sea level rise and why?
Well, here's one of the first complications. We don't actually know very well about the risks of ice sheet collapse. So we have a pretty good idea of what happens if the temperature stays, say, less than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial. Then we think you're kind of perturbing the system by a small enough amount that we can more or less extrapolate our present day understanding of what might result. But the problem is we're not sure. And even at 2 degrees, there is a risk, say a 5% risk perhaps, that you're going to get fairly catastrophic, rapid loss of ice, particularly from Antarctica. We're less worried about Greenland because Greenland, the ice tends to flow down pretty confined channels that basically make their way out as fjords. So you have these mountain walls and the glacier is flowing through 5 to 10 kilometer wide channels. So even if the ice wanted to collapse very quickly, it just simply can't squeeze its way out. You know, the toothpaste can't come out of the tube tremendously quickly, even if you were squeezing it very hard. In Antarctica, you tend not to have these fjord outlets in the places we're most worried about. The ice streams, these giant outflows that control most of the outlets, are very, very wide and they aren't controlled by topography. So effectively, what happens is that the faster ice flows, the softer it gets. So you have a feedback process that the actual flow of the ice makes it softer, allowing it to go faster and faster. And this is the fun. It's exactly unlike custard in that respect. Whereas custard, if you hit it, it's very hard as a response. But if you just press it, then your finger can go into custard. The ice is the opposite to that. If you squeeze it very fast, it goes faster. It's non-Newtonian. It's a non-Newtonian fluid, as we say.
I've heard much about the West Antarctica ice sheet. Why is there particular concern there?
Yes, the interesting thing about Antarctica is, geologically speaking, the eastern part of it, which is the majority, is rather old bedrock, a little bit probably like the Baltic Shield or the much of the Canadian Arctic. And that is very old and very cold. There isn't a lot of geothermal heat coming through the base. West Antarctica, on the other hand, is much more geologically recent. There is rather large amounts of heat. There's even subglacial volcanoes in places. And furthermore, it isn't a continuous sheet of bedrock above sea level. If you remove the ice, much of it would be below sea level, and you just have a few islands poking out above the sea. And that is what we call a marine ice sheet. And the particular geometry, because the land gets deeper away from the coast, makes it unstable to collapse.
We'll get into some more detail with those specific mechanics in a moment, but let's continue our tour through the cryosphere. What about sea ice? The Arctic, the North Pole, if you will, has very little land, and this is largely ice floating on the sea in contrast to the South Pole. I presume you've heard about ice-free summers and so forth. What's happening there, and why should we be concerned?
Yes, there is significant loss of ice, Arctic sea ice. Of course, that doesn't change sea level effectively because it's already floating. The big problem with the Arctic sea ice is that ice is much brighter than ocean. And so if you remove the ice cover, the oceans get significantly warmer much quicker because of this difference in albedo. You can value that change in albedo in terms of how it would increase the temperatures in the rest of the planet and how much damage you might expect. And figures are around, 5 to $10 trillion of damage per year as a result of losing the Arctic sea ice. Now, I don't know if those numbers are at all reasonable, really, but certainly been published in the literature. So you may think at first glance, well, it doesn't matter so much. The Arctic, the seasonal ice comes and goes. There isn't a huge inertia. So in climate models, if you remove all the sea ice today, it will grow back pretty much the same within 4 years. So it's not a high inertia system like the ice sheets or even mountain glaciers, but it is important to the global climate system as a whole.
Moving back onto land, but more temperate areas of land, mountain glaciers are also retreating. How are mountain glaciers responding in a way different than, let's say, the ice sheets in Greenland in particular sound analogous because of the fjords? Is it similar or different?
Again, that's an interesting question. Certainly, mountain glaciers, traditionally, when I was a kid doing glaciology, we thought these were important because they reacted on timescales of decades to hundreds of years, because they're relatively small and not very thick. So you can change, the melting, the throughput of the ice takes only 100 years or so from a snowflake to carving off or melting. However, now that we understand more about the dynamics of ice sheets, we realize that some particular ice sheets can also have these century-type timescales for collapse. So maybe there's not such a big difference after all in the timescales associated with them. Certainly, mountain glaciers in most parts of the world have been retreating, of course, since the Little Ice Age. People are used to seeing paintings of glaciers in Switzerland and now very much smaller remnants of that. And we would expect that to continue. Something like only a third of the mountain glaciers around the world will be left by the end of this century. And that's significant for many communities because the ice has provided a source of water, especially during the arid and hot summer. So that's a significant loss, even if it probably will only raise sea level by perhaps 20, 30 centimeters as a whole over this century.
And finally, permafrost. This is something that's brought up often with the prospect of these positive feedback cycles with further warming and releases of subterranean gas. What's happening with permafrost in general and specifically with the prospect of methane releases that I've heard of?
Yeah, of course, I think one thing that puts it into context is that there's twice as much carbon preserved frozen organic material in the permafrost. In the upper 3 meters of permafrost, there's twice as much carbon as in the atmosphere at the present time. So if this carbon bomb goes off, in a way, mitigation agreements become entirely moot. Now, it's expected that permafrost is going to retreat. It's kind of hard to accurately measure how permafrost is doing. It's not very amenable to a lot of remote sensing, so you rely a lot on models. But certainly, it's expected to retreat rather significantly over this century. And how much that makes a difference to the atmosphere, you're right. It does depend on how much is released as CO2, which tends to happen in dry conditions, or as methane, which is the situation if you have more anaerobic environment. So it does depend very much on location where you're talking about, what kind of emissions they're going to be. And the way permafrost degrades, it tends to do it very patchily. It can collapse and form large lakes, or it might just take these thermokarst type processes. Permafrost, it's a bit like sea ice. It's very messy. It's very variable. There's organics, there's the vegetation cover, there's things like reindeer herding over significant parts of the permafrost. So all of these have impacts on permafrost stability as well.
I guess one last thing on permafrost. Last I read, permafrost was expected to add something in the ballpark of 10 to 15% on top of the emissions that we're going to emit. So it's going to make a fairly big difference. Is that in the right ballpark there?
Yeah, I would say something like that, sure. We did an analysis of how much carbon would be saved, if you like, by doing something like the GEOMET G4 experiment, which is something like a Mount Pinatubo eruption every 4 years, amount of sulfur in the atmosphere. And yes, that saves some trillions per year in terms of damages that you get just by avoiding very large temperature rises. So that's, even relative to what you would get with the RCP 4.5, which is pretty close to the 2015 Paris NDC agreements to what pathway we are on at the moment.
Right. So focusing back in on ice sheets, I've got the sense that the ice sheets are one of the least certain aspects of our impact on the Earth system. Many aspects of climate change are quite uncertain. At least in many respects, a good grasp on most of the key processes. Whereas it seems in ice sheet science, lots of fairly big discoveries and big changes in thinking have been happening in recent years. How uncertain is the picture for ice sheets and their evolution?
Of course, that's a great question. And, it's very interesting when you compare the process-based physics models of how much sea level rise we would expect with an expert solicitation of how much the actual authors, the glaciologists, think we might get. And there is quite a large difference between those two numbers. So the people that know about the models know their models are not particularly great. And the reason why they're not great, to a large degree, is about calving, the iceberg calving process. And I think one way of understanding why that's difficult to include in models is that the cracking of ice and the calving takes place at the speed of sound. But of course, the glaciers are flowing tremendously slowly. A fast glacier is flowing at something like a kilometer per year. So you're talking very many orders of magnitude, different speed of processes that a good model should try to simulate. And it's very much like in atmospheric physics, where it's extremely difficult to simulate processes in a cloud compared with what's happening in terms of what we think of climate. Yeah, so the difficulty is that in the ice sheet model, we have to try and parameterize calving. And there are actually quite a lot of different ways of doing it. And it's reasonably well understood to some degree. But if you want to really push the system, such as we might do with larger rises in temperature, then it gets very uncertain as to what's likely to happen. And then on top of that, you have this marine ice sheet instability, whereby just simply geometrically, if you have the land beneath the ice getting deeper, further away from the coast, then you tend to be in an unstable configuration. So I always liken it to a ball rolling down the hill. It's just going to build up speed. Even if the climate remains the same, it will accelerate until you do something to actually stop that ball physically from being able to roll down the hill.
Marine ice sheet instability, it's an idea that I found a little difficult to get my head around. So we get to drill in a little bit more, because the way I'm picturing it is the ice sheet used to be, before this marine ice sheet instability is kicked off, it used to be grounded on like a high point. So it's sort of at the edge of the ice sheet, there's a lip of rock. But then as you go inland, it kind of slopes down so that the ice sheet gets thicker and thicker and thicker. But as it retreats, the water gets under it. So does it speed up because the thickness of the ice increases? So the door is open wider, and so it flows more quickly? Am I getting that right?
There's a number of different processes taking place. One is that the temperature of the water that's going to be in contact with the ice gets warmer as you go deeper because the pressure melting point. So that you've got a bigger force acting to melt more and more ice the deeper that you go. And the other thing, as you say, is that you just open the door bigger, or if you imagine you've got the thing coming through a funnel and you have a small opening, but then you cut that and you get wider and wider as you go up the funnel, more and more water is going to flow out quicker and quicker. So, yeah, those are kind of two analogies of how it's done. But I think it is about this buttressing, how much you've got as a force that's holding back this inland ice. And that buttressing can come from the bed and high points, sticky spots on the bed in Antarctica. Or in Greenland, it can come because of the sides of the fjords. The ice is just slowed by friction as it goes through them. So that's another reason why we're not quite so concerned with the Greenland ice sheet, even though maybe a handful of these fjords are very deep and penetrate all the way into the interior of the ice sheet. So they can also be subject to marine ice sheet instability in those Greenland outlets, as well as the West Antarctic ones.
Give people a better sense of the geography of these ice sheets, because on one end, we have mountain glaciers, which are thoroughly planted on land. And the way they lose their mass is by melting. They flow downhill and then they can melt as they get to lower temperatures, as the higher temperatures at lower altitudes. But both Greenland and Antarctica have parts of the ice sheet that aren't just sitting on land, are actually sitting over ocean or over land that is below water level. So can you describe kind of the geographic setup of the two ice sheets? Like how much of them sits under sea level? And how big a difference does that make to their evolution?
Yeah, so I think there's roughly speaking 60 meters of global sea level locked up in the ice in Antarctica. And most of that is in East Antarctica. And most of it is in what we could call regular bedrock that's above sea level. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that we would be used to seeing. But this West Antarctic ice sheet, there are parts of it that are 2 kilometers below present-day sea level. So those would be rather deep ocean if you took away the ice. The only reason that the ice is like still resting on the bed is because it's so very, very thick, more than 4 kilometers in some places. And this ice is something that's taken tens of thousands of years to build up, because you build an ice sheet very slowly because it can only snow a certain amount every year, maybe a meter at maximum. Whereas you can melt things away very much more quickly. You can have melt rates, the grounding line where this ice flows off and into the ocean, because the ocean is very warm. And you know, when you get into a bathtub of cold water, you get cold very quick or very hot. Yeah, the heat transfer is very efficient compared with the air. So you can get melt rates of around 100 meters a year for where that ice is flowing off the land. So things happen tremendously quickly at these large outlets of the ice streams of Antarctica and Greenland, compared with the general surface, which things happen rather slowly.
Another thing, the different types of ice that are around. So sea ice is floating on the water. And if it melts, it doesn't contribute to sea level rise. It's relatively thin, a few meters. And then we've got these big ice sheets and glaciers on land. But as they kind of get away from the land and onto the water, you get these ice shelves, right? And they play quite a strong role. These are very, very thick, sort of floating tongues of the ice sheet. What's their role in keeping these things intact?
Well, the ice shelves, when the glaciers go off the continent, you can have it in something like 1,000 meters of water, especially in Antarctica, but also Jakobshavn Glacier in Greenland, that's carving into an 800-meter deep fjord. So the water 800 meters deep is rather different from the situation at the surface. That's very, very important to understand. You know, sea ice, yes, it's only a few meters thick, and you have this huge volume of sea ice, or huge area, I should say, because it's, of course, thick, not very thick, all the way around Antarctica. And that, when it melts, makes the upper surface of the ocean not very salty. You know, you have a lot of fresh water there, and a lot of fresh water introduced from beneath the ice sheet as well. So these ice shelves which start out 1,000 meters thick and then gradually being melted by the warm oceans underneath until they get to perhaps 100 or 200 meters thick, at which point they lose their structural integrity and things like tidal effects are bending them, and you get a carving of these huge giant icebergs from there. Yeah, sea ice, it's much more variable. So it's something that can be changed almost by the weather, you know, something that changes on less than a decadal time scale. Whereas we're used to thinking of the ice sheets as changing only on these Milankovitch time scales, really. That used to be the case, where you have this 100,000 years time scale of slow accumulation of the ice sheet and then a 10,000 year interglacial during which the ice gradually melts. But now we understand by better records of geology and better understanding of what's going on with the glaciers as well, that this disintegration can happen very, very quickly. You can have, we've seen in the geological record, sea level rise rates of 5 meters in a century at the end of the last ice age. Obviously, that would be very, very catastrophic in the present day, given all of the infrastructure around the world's coastlines. But we know it's happened in the past. What we don't know is exactly what caused that massive sudden rise in sea level.
I mean, I guess as the ice sheet of the last ice age was retreating, it was in quite different places with different geographies than our current ice sheets. So does it provide a very strong direct constraint, or is it much more of an indirect constraint on our understanding of the threat from sea level rise?
There is a technique called fingerprinting, whereby people go to coral reefs around the world, and you can see the rates of sea level rise in different geographic locations. And that helps to tie down where that water came from. Because if Antarctica melts or if Greenland melts, you get different distribution of sea level because the mass is lost from the ice in those ice sheets and it's converted into water, which spreads itself out around the globe. So if you can look at how sea level changed, you can get some idea of what was the source of that water. And I think some of the evidence is that it seems to be from Antarctica that at least some of that large increase came from. It doesn't seem to have been Scandinavian or the Laurentide ice sheet over North America.
I guess one interesting fact to add on there, I believe I'm right. If all the ice on Greenland melted away, the sea level around Greenland would fall rather than rising. Because the gravitational pull of that great block of mass weakens, and then so the relative gravitational surface of the Earth kind of,
And in fact, that's actually a problem for Greenlanders. They are finding boats, their fishing boats, are hitting rocks that aren't charted on their maps because they didn't used to be needed to be charted. They were quite happily sailing over the top of them, but now they're hitting them.
So I want to get towards marine glacier geoengineering, this idea you've been working on for a few years. But just to give a recap, why are marine glaciers so important? Because it's relatively small parts of the system that have a disproportionate impact. Is that right?
Yeah, this marine ice sheet instability applies literally to a handful of outlets in Antarctica and Greenland. And the parts of Antarctica that are susceptible probably only can add something like 5 meters to global sea level. Perhaps there's maybe 3 meters in West Antarctica and a couple of meters in East Antarctica that are vulnerable. And the key thing is the speed, how fast these outlets can collapse away. And that's the point of the marine ice sheet instability and the point of it being very uncertain in Antarctica. You have this combination of the bedrock getting deeper away from the coast inland, and you have this very unconfined, huge, wide outlets that mean the whole of the toothpaste is very, very wide. You can get a lot of ice out there very, very quickly compared with everywhere else, like the normal terrestrial-based ice sheets. If you like, that would be a graceful solution. If all of the world's ice sheets were resting on, looks like, most of East Antarctica, we wouldn't be so concerned because those melt rates would be sufficiently slow that we would have time to deal and adapt with the rising sea levels around the world. But the truth is that they really aren't. We've got multi-meter commitments of sea level rise that according to the estimates and observations, seem to be already triggered into this unstable regime. The ice shells have been thinned to the point at which the buttressing they provided has been taken away. So the ice outlets, Thwaites Glacier, Pine Island Glacier in Antarctica, Jakobshavn Glacier in parts of the Northeast Greenland ice stream in Greenland, have accelerated dramatically over the last 10 to 20 years. And according to the theory of how we understand it, they won't stop accelerating. They will increase their rate of acceleration as this progresses. That's the key reason why we need to be concerned about the marine ice sheets.
And this is a process that, rather than evolving over the course of thousands or tens of thousands of years, might occur over the course of hundreds.
Oh, yeah, for sure. These outlets are resting on beds that are not inherently very sticky. They're probably resting a lot on essentially sand, and sand that is very close to flat and full of liquid. So it's almost like it's floating on a bath. Doesn't have a lot of basal friction, except for a few key areas called sticky spots and these particular islands that used to be slowing down the ice shelves. But the ice shelves are too thin to hit those parts now.
So these are still some fairly large geological or geographic features we're talking about here. And yet you're proposing, and the team you're working with are proposing, that we could intervene to actually modify the dynamics to help stop, hold back somehow these marine glaciers. What are the ideas, and how practical are they?
Well, the first thing to say is that we're not actually trying to hold them back physically. We are not proposing giant concrete pillars or anything like that. The point is that we want to give nature a helping hand. We just want to return the melt rates to how they were maybe 50 years ago. That's very difficult in a sense, because the ocean has been heating because of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases for a long time, and that temperatures have been rising. And that means that the global ocean is this big reservoir of hot water. But that hot water is very dense. It's salty, and it's sitting at depths around about 500 meters or deeper. And the continental shelf of Antarctica, in front of Thwaites Glacier and the Pine Island, is just about at the same level. So that means if you slosh this deeper warm water about, it can slosh over, overflow the bathtub, if you like, and go onto the continental shelf, which then slopes downwards towards the glaciers. So this deep water is carried in channels, in the deeper channels, because it's heavy, remember. So it's flowing in these deep channels towards the ice. Now, if you could actually do something about the geometry of the channels to keep that deep, warm water away, then there isn't supply of heat to the ice sheet. So the ice sheet's going to melt less fast. So our idea is not to do something with the tens of thousands of Antarctic coastline kilometers, or even the hundreds of kilometers in front of the Thwaites Glacier, for example, but just the fairly narrow channels that are guiding this deep warm water from the global ocean underneath the outlets. And in places, the main inflow, for example, to the most vulnerable ice shelf on the planet in front of Thwaites Glacier, that warm water flows through a channel 4.5 kilometers wide. So if you could do something about that 4.5 kilometer wide channel, it might have an impact on the most vulnerable ice shelf on the planet. Now, it might not, because there can be other channels that the warm water, you block it there, the warm water just finds its way around the side and goes in anyway. So what we think is probably the best idea is go to the main trunk, the main inflow channel, which is about 80 kilometers wide, so much wider than this 4.5 kilometers. But if you can do something about the blocking the water in that main trunk, you don't need to worry about all the little sort of dendritic channels that might feed into that part as well.
Yeah, so I guess thinking about sea level rise, there's a lot of moving of earth and building of barriers that we're going to need to do to keep Jesse's home dry in the future. He lives in the Netherlands. So, I mean, they've got hundreds of kilometers, I guess, of dikes and barriers. And here you're talking about a relatively small part of the world and building some kind of barrier. What would be the nature of the barrier you're talking about putting up? Is it a dike of earth and rock, or is it something different?
Well, that's what we kind of first imagined, you know, being glaciologists rather than actual people used to getting our hands dirty. We just had this pretty stupid idea that we, embarrassing to think about it, even maybe just dredge a bit of the seafloor or like dynamite some rocks on the land and dump them in there. But of course, real engineer immediately said, well, this is crazy. You don't need to do anything like that at all. What could be done and what the potential idea is that you just need to have a thin barrier that can be removed easily, that isn't going to be environmentally damaging to this, you know, very well-preserved, something very cared for environment in Antarctica. So the idea is that it's something like these screens that you may have seen that shops or big cold rooms have, whereby a plastic screen allows forklift trucks to go in and out with the big packets of meat and stuff like that, but separates the cold air inside the freezer from the warm air outside. And instead of being anchored at the ceiling and just hanging down, what you would do, because the deep water is the thing you want to stop, you would have to have a foundation, a concrete foundation on the seafloor, and then a floating buoyant curtain that is perhaps 100 meters or 200 meters high from that concrete foundation, floating in the water with buoyancy elements like, you know, air tanks for the sake of some description, but there are many different potential kinds of buoyancy elements. The point is that the curtain has to withstand a density difference. The water nearer the ice will tend to freshen over time, so there will be a density difference pressing on the curtain. And there will be currents as well that are flowing, and that has to be resisted by the tension in the curtain, in this buoyancy. So we did a lot of calculations and some simulations about what forces would be involved. And it's not all that difficult. It gets more difficult the higher the curtain. If you wanted a curtain 400 meters high, you know, you'd need a lot more steel. The tensile strengths would be very big. But if you're talking about something 200 meters high, a normal fiberglass pipe, if you seal both ends and have it, of course, filled with air in that case, it's sufficiently strong enough to provide the buoyancy. And the material, it's completely uncertain what it might be. But one material that we believe would work is something called high molecular weight polyethylene, which is about 50 times stronger than normal steel and is very inert and used in a lot of applications where you need the coefficient of friction is similar to Teflon. So that's one potential material. We've also been working, the Norwegians that we work with are very, very keen to try to have entirely natural solutions. So they have been looking at things like hemp and canvas and these old style materials from the sailing days and have some ideas to even use it as a kind of fishing resource that you could imagine mussels or various seafood growing on this kind of curtain. Wouldn't be very relevant for Antarctica, but we wouldn't start in Antarctica. We would go through places in Greenland, and this might be of some more interest to Greenlanders.
So this idea of these floating barriers to keep one body of water separate from another, has this been done before in other contexts, or is this a completely novel idea?
No, we only discovered this much later than we actually got the idea for doing these curtains. But then we discovered that reservoirs use curtains that are floating from the surface and of the order of, say, half a kilometer long and 100 meters deep to separate waters of different temperatures to try to preserve the ecosystems downstream when they let water out of reservoirs and dams. So something similar is used in rather similar context already. And this is done in the US and China. I don't know other countries, but anyway, at least those.
So it seems that this is potentially quite doable, but I've heard Antarctic waters are rather difficult to operate in. What are the prospects of, you know, constructing something, you said, tens of kilometers long, 100 meter high, underneath storm-racked, iceberg-laden waters of Antarctica? Can this be done?
It would be, without doubt, the hardest construction project humanity has ever undertaken. It is non-trivial. However, and I speak as someone who's abandoned ship in Antarctica, so I am aware of the dangers and the difficulties of working down there. The thing is that you don't need to go to any particular geographical location at any particular time. Because we're talking about something 80 kilometers long, you can go to a particular place, put your foundations in that part. Maybe icebergs come along and you have to move, and you can work in some other location. It's something that we suppose could be built over a decade. It wouldn't be done in one season. I assume we would be working in the summer season. So we budgeted for 100-day seasons for a fleet of 5 purpose-built icebreakers and 10 support vessels, special constructed support vessels, semi-submersible, that would carry these large concrete caissons and also the curtains rolled, probably, that could be located onto the seafloor by remote-controlled vehicles, and then basically released, and they would unroll and go out into position.
So it sounds like you've thought this through quite thoroughly. I mean, you mentioned it's a very challenging engineering task, but as I mentioned, we're facing a very challenging and very distributed engineering task of dealing with sea level rise around the world. What's the kind of rough estimate of how much this thing could cost? For maybe for a couple of examples.
Okay, I'll give you the headline figure to start with. After calculating all of the different components and the icebreakers, capital costs, etc. So we think this 80-kilometer long curtain blocking the main channel to Thwaites would come in something between $40 to $80 billion for construction. And that's including contingencies and things like this. That sounds like a hell of a lot of money. It's spread out over a 10-year period, and you have to compare that directly with the costs of maintaining coastal defenses all around the globe, which coincidentally come in at $40 billion per year. And this would be something that we would expect to have a 100-year lifespan. The curtain elements would be replaced about every 20 years, but the concrete foundation should last something of a 100-year period. So it's a few percent, or 1 or 2%, of the costs of global coastal protection. And of course, we argue it's much more equitable than people in developing world countries having to construct coastal protection, and therefore much more desirable to try to keep the system as close to the present day as it is already. And you have to look at what would also happen if you did nothing. And this is a key element compared with standard geoengineering kind of things, whereby it's about not just if we took our hands off and said Antarctica is so pristine, we shouldn't go in there. It will change radically if the ice sheet starts to melt and contribute multimeter amounts of sea level rise globally. That will include hundreds of kilometers of glacial retreat, massive changes to the ecology and to the geography of both the land and the marine parts where all this is taking place. So doing nothing will actually create catastrophic environmental change in Antarctica. Actually, conserving by this kind of construction is likely to produce much less damaging overall cost.
I'm going to change gears here, perhaps a bit radically, to the aspect of your work that first brought us into contact with each other, and that was your leadership of the solar geoengineering program in China, which ran for 5 years, roughly, I believe, 2013 to 2018, give or take a year. You can correct me if I'm wrong. How did you end up, in particular, how did you, as a British person, end up in China heading up a geoengineering program?
like all things, it's a matter of a series of unfortunate events, you know, it just random chance almost. I was going to be leading an expedition in Svalbard, ice core drilling, and I badly injured my neck in a skiing accident in Lapland. And the people took over just basically were doing an absolutely terrible job. And I was getting these satellite calls every day, and I was very uncomfortable with my neck and getting extremely frustrated that I went to the travel agent and said, "Look, get me out of here. I don't care where to." And they said, "Oh, we've got some cheap tickets to China. Why don't you go there?" So I said, "Sure, great." So I got on a plane to China and basically only thought about what I was going to do once I was there, but knew a couple of guys in the Polar Research Center in Shanghai, visited them, had a good time around China. And then in contact, they said, "Hey, you know, there's this job coming up in this new institute in Beijing. You might be interested." So I said, "Sure, yeah." And I went out again. They liked what I was doing and how I was. So I decided to move 3/4 time to China, but keep 1/4 time in Finland. And when I got there, it was just this wide open field, you know, do what you want to do. Here's a ton of resources, people, money, basically do what you like. And the guy, the former minister of science in China, Xu Guanhua, it was his idea to develop this new institute. And he'd seen this article that we wrote that was published in PNAS about geoengineering and sea level rise. And he just said, "John, put together $5 million program on geoengineering." And that was not my idea at all. And I kind of said, "Oh, no. Oh, God." And so then I had to go and do a whole bunch of, you know, handshaking and presentations around China, trying to get this thing going, which was very unsuccessful at first because no one knew me from Adam. You know, it took a long time to get the credibility, the guanxi into the system. But after a couple of years, I was able to do that. And then we got this proposal through the system and basically kicked it off like that. So it was... there was a couple of very random coincidences that led to that.
And where do things stand now with geoengineering in China? I haven't heard much coming from that direction since the end of this program. Can you give any indication about the level of interest in both the scientific community as well as among policymakers?
Yeah, actually, the project, I think, was more like from maybe 2015 to 20, so a little bit later than what you said. But yeah, it would have been very good to continue with it. I think there's been a few things that have changed there. The COVID situation has not been good for any kinds of cooperation or any sorts of, let's say, new ideas and international links, etc. But even before that, I think China was moving away from trying to work internationally, especially on these kinds of controversial sorts of issues. It was a lot less on the priority list of the top scientists there, which is a real shame. And the other thing was that when I moved my family to Finland from China because I had young kids and it's a much nicer environment in Finland for the kids, there wasn't anybody with a very kind of strong track record at a senior level that could push this forwards. And that's how it works in China. A lot of it is driven by the people that are senior enough to create programs. And I guess without me, there kind of has been a bit of a lack in some way.
We always conclude our conversations with the look to the future. And given the often dark nature of the subject matter, we like to counterbalance that by asking our guests, what is your source of optimism?
Yeah, well, you know, young people, of course, are a great source of optimism. And whenever I present these things to do with cryospheric conservation, and it's not just these seabed curtains, but there are a whole bunch of other things that we're working with the University of Arctic on as well. And young people love the idea that you can break down this horrible, huge problem that seems so depressing into manageable chunks. Like I talked about, if instead of trying to deal with the whole world's coastline, you can just deal with something 80 kilometers across, it seems a much more tractable problem to deal with. And I think young people love that. And that's what gives me hope. They're enthusiastic. And, you know, there's so many people now that are very good, young NGO types, actually quite rich guys that all like this idea. And all of these guys are pushing for this to try to get done. And that gives me tremendous optimism, actually, for the future. We have the tools. And I think we can do this. It's just about, in a sense, having the courage to choose to do it.
This has been glaciologist and all-around climate researcher, Professor John Moore. John, thank you for joining us on Challenging Climate.
Pleasure.
Well, thanks for listening. Please rate or review us on Apple Podcasts and elsewhere, and consider supporting us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/challengingclimate.